Hey everybody, this episode of the Press Row Podcast is brought to you by Out of the Park Baseball 18. Yes, we have officially announced Out of the Park Baseball 18 coming on March 24th, 2017. But if you pre-order it today, you can pick it up for a 10% discount. Get it for just $35.99 and you get it a few days early. Early access on March 20th, 2017. Out of the Park Baseball 18 is the follow-up to the 2016 Metacritic PC Game of the Year. And we've added a whole bunch of cool new stuff to the game, including but not limited to, obviously, the 2017 opening day rosters across the majors and the minors. You got 8 international leagues in addition to the American major leagues and minor leagues. We've got a cool new challenge mode and online user profiles that let you compare and contrast with your friends and maybe your enemies what you've been accomplishing. There's an improved 3D mode with game highlight reels, which is really fun. TJ is going to love that. We've got tournaments and fall leagues, including the Arizona Fall Leagues, plus you can set up your own national or international tournaments. The Negro Leagues have been added, so some of those great players from the past, like Satchel Paige and Josh Gibson, you can use them for the first time ever. We've got improved AI for the rosters, for trades, and in-game AI been optimized and enhanced. There's a redesigned injury system and a whole bunch more stuff. Out of the Park Baseball 18. You can pre-order today, get 10% off the regular price of $39.99. Get it for just $35.99. Go to OOTP Developments today. Support indie sports games. Support the Press Row Podcast. Out of the Park Baseball 18.
Hey, everyone. Thanks for tuning in to the Press Row Podcast. We're now just about to mid-February, and sports gaming news is starting to pick up. Info on MLB The Show 17 gameplay improvements, Mutant Football League's successful Kickstarter campaign, and the continued downfall of E3 will be covered later in the episode. But we start in the world of esports. The competitive arena is one that, for the sports gaming genre at least, is just in its infancy. In recent days, the two biggest sports game publishers, EA Sports and 2K Sports, have been involved with enormous developments within esports. For EA, their Madden Bowl event was entertaining to watch, but marred by offensive social media posts from the winner. With 2K, they announced a partnership with the NBA to create an actual esports league involving all 30 NBA teams and made up of 5 full-time players per squad. I'm your host, Brian Weedy, and we begin by bringing in Rich Grisham to discuss the continued growing pains as they relate to EA and Madden. You know, Rich, the story should have been that the games were once again entertaining to watch, despite the players running mostly the same plays throughout. But instead, it became about the conduct of the winning player and the trouble that created for EA especially. What was your kind of reaction to what has taken place since all the comments came to light and with how EA has handled the situation?
Well, Brian, you're a friend of mine, and I have a lot of respect for you, but I do not think that it was a good situation for this stuff that this guy said to be brought to light. I don't know what the description of me is, but I really wish that none of this had ever happened. I know that the world out there, people are very brash with their social media, and people love to say things that are things that would make a lot of people uncomfortable. But ultimately, I just wish that none of this had ever even been brought up, because I think it is not the kind of story that we want to hear about, with so much negativity in the world already, and so many people constantly going to break people down or break organizations down. I don't think it merited the conversation in the first place.
Well, I mean, it's pretty much unavoidable. I mean, it was already over social media because that's where it came from. And this is actually not the first time that a participant in a Madden event has been found to have offensive comments in their past. So what happens is you get someone being thrown into the spotlight, and they represent a multi-billion dollar corporation at the same time. All of a sudden, they are a representative for them. And EA is a company with a market cap of nearly $25 billion. And so this, their image is very important to them for their brand and their company as a whole. And you see it in any area of sports. As far as video games go, you see it with cover athletes. You see it with anyone who appears in their commercials. You see it with anyone who endorses their products, that they have to meet a certain standard. And if they don't, the company doesn't want to be associated with them. And for example, John Jones a couple of years ago, who was on the cover of EA Sports UFC, and they had to drop him from the mobile game as far as the loading screens and the icon on the phone, because he had been in legal trouble. And you see it throughout sports, whether it's guys getting arrested, guys getting caught with doing drugs, or making offensive comments, whether it's in the public, whether it's social media or elsewhere, or being involved in domestic violence, whatever it is, that once you're representing a company, the rules change, right? The rules are very different as far as a contract between a company and an individual and how they represent their brand. And so what you see is, and in politics, you see that all over the place now. People are very outspoken these days against things and for things, and some of that conversation is good, and some of it's very negative, and it's just unavoidable when these things come to light, they become a big deal. And so what you have is a situation where the story wasn't so much about the individual, in my mind at least. I wrote an article that didn't even name the individual. It was about what it meant for EA Sports as far as growing their esports, and how it was another challenge for them, and that they weren't really prepared for it. If you go throughout the world of esports and with the major games that are involved in esports, you find very strict morals clauses because they know what to expect, and they know exactly what they need to prevent from happening and what they can do when certain things do happen. And you see people involved in esports get suspended or released from their squads, from whoever has the team put together, disciplining them for in whatever way may be the case. And it's something that EA hasn't faced. They're very new to this. They get 10,000 to 25,000 views on Twitch when they're running the competitions, as opposed to some of the bigger games, which gets hundreds of thousands to millions of viewers. And so those companies have been through those growing pains. EA is now going through the growing pains, and they're learning from it. And I mean, they released a statement even just the other day addressing objectionable social media posts. And they were specific to those made during and after. So it wasn't only the past posts, which were racial in origin, but comments that were made during and after the Madden Bowl to people on social media. And EA penalized them for that, and they took away 4%. It wasn't much, but 4% of the $75,000 in winnings. Took away some championship points in the Madden series that could affect their chances at winning the big invitational later in the year, but it didn't address those past posts. And I think what that tells you a lot about is what standards EA had in place, what people agreed to beforehand, which was you can't retroactively punish someone if you didn't have an agreement in writing about what was appropriate and what wasn't. So they dealt with what was happening now, and then they're going to adjust that for the future, tighten up a morals clause. They're going to monitor people's past, and they're going to review people's past, and they're going to monitor their current actions on social media. So I think it's a big learning experience for EA as they try and grow into a big esport.
Okay, I mean, you're talking to a guy who, we have everybody in the Out of the Park organization sign a social code of conduct, where whenever we are interacting with our community, we do it positively. We don't use profanity. We don't use vulgarity. You know, we try to be as helpful and supportive as possible. And when things do go negative, we then disengage, because that's just how I feel that an organization should engage with its community. As long as people are being respectful or genuine, we'll do exactly the same. What I think, at least from my, I'm just speaking for me, like I'm really, this is a very different world that we live in than just a few years ago, since the sort of the barriers have been broken by YouTube and Twitch and podcasts and Instagram and Snapchat. There's no more censoring of anything anymore. Actresses and actors, musicians, my goodness. I mean, just listen to some modern music. The things that are said are incredibly offensive and vulgar and profane. You know, movies that are made nowadays are much more over the top with things that are said and done. Athletes are constantly saying things that are, you know, the athletes of the 70s, 80s, 90s, had they said, would have been ridden out of town. You know, the discourse has gotten so toxic in so many communities. I just felt like this is a manufactured controversy that didn't need to be amplified even more than it was. By no means am I defending any of the things that this guy did. But my goodness, can we try to be more positive with how we deal with these games that we love? These are video games. These are competitions. I don't know. It's so difficult anymore to even go anywhere and not get sucked into some sort of horrible, toxic conversation, it feels. And I just wish that it weren't like that.
Well, yeah, I think you have to root out some of the issues first to move on from that. I mean, what would happen if esports continued to grow, but these kind of checks on things were never put into place? Then you'll have something even bigger happen later down the line that can't be managed. So as far as from a corporate standpoint, I think it's advantageous to them to get ahead of it now.
Right. No, look at the MLB live stream. Did you see some of the comments that were made during the live Twitch stream of the MLB The Show thing? I mean,
right.
It's just awful. Like, so many people are saying and producing so much horrible content. It's just this avalanche that is impossible to deal with anymore.
That's a different situation, though, because that's...
Yes. Know, oh, totally.
Chat rooms and comment sections and YouTube, those places have been cesspools for a long time. But those people also aren't being paid by the corporation to represent them.
Agreed.
They're not being used in promotional material. So that's where the concern comes in. And again, the only way you can improve on that is to put things in place to... say, okay, this is inappropriate. We consider this to be inappropriate, and we don't want this to reflect our values, and we don't want the, and because ultimately it comes down to perception. It really doesn't matter. They're a business. What matters to them is this going to hurt our bottom line or not? Right? If it didn't, they wouldn't have even reacted to it. But they don't want to be associated with that, and they want to create that positive environment. And I think the only way you do that is by addressing the issues when you have the opportunity to do so. And it's an unfortunate situation, but it was also, it was brought upon by a few individuals, and hopefully that has, that they've learned from that. And hopefully going forward, other competitors will know, this, once we enter into this, it's a contract to be, where we're going to be examined. We're going to be scrutinized. That comes with being in the public light.
I know, but the reporting of it feels to me like almost how some video game websites will run articles about, communities that produce pornographic images of video game characters. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, to me, there's some things that deserve to be discussed and produced on certain pages of sites that people go to, you know, and there's some things that are better left just not dug up and brought out, and let the people involved with it deal with it the way that they would deal with it. So I don't know. It's
a beautiful, you know, thought. It's a beautiful thought, Rich. I agree. It's a beautiful thought. It's just, it's unfortunate, but that's not the way things work. I mean, imagine if it was a situation in the world of, you know, in the realm of League of Legends or Counter-Strike, or, you know, we've seen, we've already seen in Counter-Strike the gambling.
Some of the nastiest, messiest communities in the world right
and,
there.
And in the esports itself, there's all sorts of contractual people breaking contracts, people not getting paid for what they're supposed to get paid for. There's a lot of ugly stuff in esports because, again, we're talking about a lot of money on both ends for the companies, for the people involved, for the people working for them. There is a lot of stuff that, you know, as sports games grow in esports, we're going to face a lot of different issues along the way. And this is just, I think this is just kind of the start of it. And this is something that can be managed, though, if everybody learns from it and realizes that, you know, it's a big picture situation when you start talking about hundreds of thousands of dollars and you start talking about an industry, an esports industry that deals in the tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars, and corporations that, that are worth billions upon billions of dollars, that they're going to be scrutinized to this extent. It'd be nice, Rich. You know, I'm not a negative person. I rarely have to cover something negatively, besides just pure new video game news. But it was really, I thought, kind of unavoidable. All right, so on the other end of the spectrum, we have NBA 2K, who really seems to be making a push for growing beyond just the year-to-year way that we've seen out of sports games now, and holding a tournament, getting a few more viewers on board, and then next year holding another tournament and kind of building off that. 2K and the NBA are partnering up for an actual league, and we're talking about every NBA franchise having a team that's tied to them and employing, literally employing, as far as Strauss Zelnick, who's the CEO of Take-Two, saying this is will be a full-time job for everyone involved. Teams of five players controlling essentially their My Player characters, like they do now in the Pro-Am mode, and playing a season, an actual season, as far as regular season games against the other teams, playoffs, and then eventually a championship series. So there's a lot going on here, and they're looking at launching it in 2018. I wouldn't be surprised if that ends up getting pushed back, because this is a big, big initiative. There's a lot of moving parts. And, you know, I have a lot of feelings about this, Rich, from as far as 2K, they have some issues they have to solve in order for this really to work. But the potential of it seems to be huge from my perspective, if they're able to pull that off. What do you think about what NBA 2K is doing here?
Man, a lot of thoughts on this that we'll get into. I'll lead off by saying, I really hope they have the right people in place to run this thing. Now, the NBA is arguably the world's best professional sports league in terms of how it manages the property, right? How it promotes its players, how it reaches around the world, how it handles digital media, how it handles merchandising, all of those things. Obviously, it is helmed by incredibly smart, talented people. The same thing with the guys on NBA 2K. It is the world's, well, it's not the world's best-selling sports game, but it, what did they just announce a day or two ago? They did 7 or 8 million copies, the most ever. And the most ever copies for an NBA 2K game, which is saying something. So clearly, the guys who are making and running the NBA 2K franchise are very smart. They're very good at what they do. But esports is completely different. Completely different on so many different levels. The way that, number one, the amount of money at the top end when you talk about League of Legends and Counter-Strike and Dota and those things. The undercurrent of nastiness around the communities in a lot of cases and the fact that it is a technology event as opposed to an athletic event presents a whole host of problems, you know, potential cheating or, you know, potential shenanigans or potential crashes or failures with money on the line. There's so many aspects to running an esports league that I really hope they have the right people in place to do this, because there's a lot of opportunity for success, but there's probably just as much, if not more, opportunity for problems when you talk about establishing a new esports league.
So let's talk about one of those, and that's probably the most prominent as far as, certainly on social media, where every tweet from 2K about this and really about anything regards their servers, right? And so currently in NBA 2K17, we have a long history of NBA 2K having online issues, but in 2K17, it's 2017, Rich, and we have the Pro-Am mode where a number of people, all too frequently, people are getting kicked out of Pro-Am games, which, when you lose someone from your team, a CPU character, the CPU controls them instead, and that's a huge disadvantage. And we have a tournament that's going on currently where this is happening. This is happening during a tournament which involves money, which they are promoting heavily. So that's an issue, I think, first of all. That's the biggest one they're going to have to tackle, because presumably they're calling this kind of a worldwide thing that they're going to do. Presumably these teams aren't traveling to play locally.
Presumably, right. I mean, as you mentioned, there's a lot that they haven't talked about the mechanics, right? They don't know if they're going to have all the teams ready at the start. You know, they're talking about the individual basketball teams owning these esports teams. I can't imagine something more different than owning an NBA team versus owning an esports team. I mean, talk about just a completely different set of everything. I have to believe that they're going to have separate walled off infrastructure to support this that's going to be dedicated only to running this. Because if they don't, I shudder to think about what could happen. I mean, all it's going to take is one time when an event is happening and teams are playing and there's a freeze or a glitch or a crash and it gets booted. Everybody gets booted out to the main screen. That becomes a meme, you know, forever. Man, again, like, just there's a lot of smart people that are, I'm sure, going to put a lot of things in place to make this work. But this is not the same kind of thing like a League of Legends or a Dota. This is a new, there's a new league with a new way of playing the game and new affiliations. And, you know, what's the crossover of the fans who like the NBA, who will like NBA 2K Esports? What affiliations will the players, the esports players, have with the team? Oh man, my goodness, I just can't even. There's so many, so many questions, so many things to think about with this thing.
And one of the other biggest things in my mind is the reliance within 2K games of virtual currency and how that has affected the balance of what we already have in these tournaments, which is you get an advantage if you've spent a lot of money to upgrade your character and if you spent a ton of time with your character playing games. And so the competitive balance is not there currently. Competitive balance will have to be there for this. So it becomes something like, are they going to implement what you have in EA Sports Hockey League, which is you have pre-built character types. And then that way, what your strategy comes in is putting those character types together and then taking advantage of their best traits and covering up your weakest traits as a team. Or are they going to allow people to customize their characters even more? And if they do that, they have to find a way to prevent an unfair advantage for one team over another and all of that. There's a lot of stuff they're going to have to to keep an eye on here and put into place so that it is a fair system. But all that being said, what I like about this is twofold, and that's that you have an actual league, actual season, because right now I honestly couldn't care less about individuals who go on to play in tournaments. I have no rooting interest in these people. And I would imagine that's part of why viewership really isn't high for sports video games when they're streamed. This is more of a team concept. You're following them throughout a season. And it creates, along with that, storylines. So you get to know the teams, you get to know the people, you get storylines, you get teams who maybe are you know, start slow and build up over a season. You get rivalries, you get things of that nature that'll make it more interesting to follow. And then also, if you're tying them to these teams, if you're a fan of the Golden State Warriors and the Golden State Warriors NBA 2K E-League team, it's probably going to be, you might go along with them as your esports team to follow. I think you might find that that association between the teams, between the NBA teams and the E-League teams, as something that's more appealing than what we have now.
Possible. It's certainly different, and different could be good. I don't know if there will be any of that crossover. I don't know if there even needs to be any of that crossover. Perhaps it's not about crossover. It's just about, like you say, establishing that foundation. Right? I mean, one of the things that is incredibly difficult for most people who are not already into esports to get into esports is because just the teams are not named after anything other than particular sponsors, and the individual players on the teams move around constantly, and you know the turnover is close to 100%, and the burnout rate among the players is incredibly high. It's a very, very, very hard way. It's like, you know, it's like the old AC/DC song. It's a long way to the top if you want to rock and roll. Like, there's a few dudes at the top of the esports world making some big money, and tens of thousands below, right below that level, that aren't making anything, that are just, you know, killing themselves to get there. So does a new way of, you know, does a continuity of teams and a tradition or the execution of a traditional sports calendar give it a better shot? I could see that. You know, I could see, and one of the things we've talked about a bunch of times, Brian, is like, if you're an American sports fan, it's kind of weird to look at European soccer. You don't really understand. In America, you have a regular season, and then a playoffs, and then a championship, whether you're talking the NFL, the Major League Baseball, the NHL, the NBA. In European soccer, you've got the regular season, but then there's no playoffs. But then there are other trophies and tournaments that you play during the season, and then, you know, there aren't really trades per se, as there might be 10 leagues across the country, across the continent, and players move around from all the different leagues, and it's just weird and bizarre to the traditional American sports fans. Similarly, esports, a lot of it is weird and bizarre to anyone who hasn't grown up in it, and maybe this fashion that they're putting in place here will make it easier to sort of, oh, this is interesting, let me watch this a little bit. At least I understand a little bit about what I'm looking at, and that lack of intimidation could help it.
Yep. You know, I think it's a really ambitious plan coming from 2K, which is something they're kind of known for, and having the NBA on board is a pretty big deal. We'll just have to see whether they can deliver on it. It's going to be interesting to follow the developments of the NBA 2K E-League.
Yeah, I don't get the sense that this is fully baked.
Right, we're too far out. Yeah.
Yeah, but I do think that, you know, on the concern side, I'm thinking you've got two organizations who don't have a lot of experience with this, who see the potential and maybe moving a little too quickly.
Yeah.
and might not have everything in place to make it happen. On the other hand, like I said, there's a lot of really smart people who work there. Perhaps they went out and recruited a few people who really know the ins and outs and do have the right infrastructure and the right people in place to actually make this a really special thing, right? The upside is nothing but great. You know, if this turns out to be something where, because of this initiative, the core game gets better, which is, I think, something that all of us can hope, right? As we've talked about in the past, when you invest in esports type features in your game, your core game better be good, right? It better not be based upon money plays or glitches or stuff like that. It better be as close to sim as possible. So that could potentially be a nice benefit. And again, the upside, if this gets put in place the right way and the core game next year is the best version ever, and the people who have success in this league are the ones who just put in the time to get really good at the game and play it the right way, it could be fantastic.
All right, we're going to welcome in TJ Larriman now, also known as That Sports Gamer, as we shift to discussing some other news of interest. First up, we have MLB The Show 17, which expanded upon the initial hints that we went over in a podcast episode a couple weeks ago in laying out the improvements to expect from gameplay this year. The first step of their rollout of information and promoting the game is gameplay related. We're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about Mutant Football League, which has reemerged after a few years. And then we're going to also get to E3 and the decision to start allowing the public to attend. But first, let's get to the MLB The Show stuff, TJ. We had the trailer, essentially. It's a 4-minute long video that went over the number of additions and improvements that the development team has put into place for MLB 17. And then they followed that up with a lengthy live stream that went about an hour and a half. What's your initial kind of reaction to the information that came out, as well as anything you saw on the stream that they held?
Yeah, just the basic gameplay stuff they showed looked pretty good, specifically the new trajectories that balls are going to take, because they've changed the way the physics work. And now a bat isn't just like a solid wall hitting the ball. It's actually taking into account like the angle and the velocity of the bat swing and stuff. So that looks pretty good. Today on the stream, they actually showed that in action a lot. The thing that we talked about last year that was really missing was like the loopers that go like over the second baseman and over the shortstop's heads mm-hmm. that drop in before the outfield. And it looks like that stuff's been, they had the developer, I think his name was Jeff something, talking about how they redid all that, and it looks real good. So there's a lot of balls that were just going over and dying before they got to the fielders. They said, however, the way it worked last time, those balls would just hang up so long that the outfielders would always have a chance and would always be diving for them. But now it looks like that's cleaned up. But that was my main takeaway from this. It looks really good. I mean, the game always looks good. But yeah, a lot of they showed off some more of the catcher stuff today. So now when a guy is stealing, you're going to kind of get like the throw meter that you get if you're using the throw meters.
Yeah.
And that's going to give you a little bit more control over your throws down a second base. It's not really just like a hold the button and pray kind of thing. So you'll get a little target that you're going to have to hit for a good throw.
My question about that, TJ, and maybe it was answered in the stream, maybe it wasn't, but from the videos that we've seen of it, including what they showed in the stream, it kind of goes into slow motion for a second and kind of pauses the action while that meter is going up. So I wonder if that's a versus CPU thing, or are you actually seeing it that way when you play an online head-to-head game? Any idea?
I don't think they got that specific, but they pretty much said that if you have your defensive throwing with meters, that's going to be on. Mm-hmm. So I would assume that's going to be on for online play.
I'm just thinking
that is going to look weird from the offenses side.
Exactly. That's what I was thinking, is that I'm just going to see a pause in the action, which maybe isn't all that unusual with our experience with MLB The Show's online, where things don't necessarily match up or things hesitate to display. But that would be kind of what I would be looking for as far as that goes. I think it's great. We definitely needed something like that. I think that's what they were referring to as the cat and mouse type of thing, was maybe not the meter, but dealing with base runners. And, you know, so that's, I think that's a positive addition, something I'm looking forward to, if it gives you a chance as a catcher to actually throw someone out instead of it just feeling random.
Yeah, and the thing that's good is if you hit it in the green area, that doesn't necessarily mean you're going to throw them out. It's still going to depend on, you know, the base runner and the pitch coming in and all that stuff. And if you don't hit the green part, it doesn't mean you're going to throw it away. It just means that it's not going to be like a right on the money throw. Mm-hmm. They said only if you get it into like the red will you actually throw it away in a center field or something.
Yeah.
So that looked pretty good.
So
they also go ahead.
Sorry, TJ.
No, they also showed a bunch of the new interactions with the fielders going after balls and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So it looks like 3-6-3 double plays are actually a thing this year.
That'll make Owen very happy.
Yeah, they do still have, they showed off a bug in the video a couple times. Sometimes the first baseman will think about coming back, and it'll still lead to the lollipop throw and the pitcher coming over to cover.
Mm.
But the whole, as long as that little bug doesn't happen, 3-6-3 and 3-6-1 double plays look a lot better. And also just regular double, they turned a bunch of double plays, and that looked good. And they showed a bunch of just like random ground balls, and you know that looked good. You can see, you feel like you see the fielder taking the time that they have, and not just rushing every throw, or not just lollygagging every throw. So it makes it feel like the defender knows how much time he has. Like you'll see them double clutch when they have extra time, or try to get it out fast when they don't.
So Rich, with the show, gameplay tends to be very technical as far as what they implement and what they advance and improve on. What's your thoughts on just the basics of what the show has in store for us as far as gameplay goes?
Well, I have played a lot of the show, especially the last two or three versions of it, especially the last two for sure. And I look at what they talked about as really addressing the few areas that I think many people would recognize needed to be addressed. For example, throwing out a runner as a catcher is something I struggle with. Now, my bigger struggle is just realizing that I need to throw it as opposed to once I throw it.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, just because I'm so locked into what I'm doing on the pitching mound, that inevitably I'm saying like 9 out of 10 times I don't start to throw it until way after I have a shot. I don't know what my what my percentage was of throwing out attempted stolen bases the last couple of years, but it had to be really low. But because that is an area that I did have issues, seeing that they're making a graphical improvement as potentially to a gameplay improvement is really cool, you know. And obviously with the bunts, we know that bunting is an area where there have been plenty of struggles. Now, as somebody who plays primarily my true 162, I don't have an issue with bunting. I don't bunt a lot myself, and the CPU doesn't bunt a lot on its own. Other than sacrifices, but I, you know, just being a part of the community and listening to TJ and watching Bullpen Banner and all that kind of stuff, it's readily apparent this is a problem in the online world. So it's heartening to hear that they are continuing to address it. Some people might say, well, gee, that's not particularly exciting, but for a game this big and this in depth and this complex, the numbers of systems that you have to create and augment and tweak to make this stuff work is mind-boggling. And so, to me, this is all a great start to the rollout of information coming out about MLB The Show.
Yeah, so my feeling on everything was that if they did these three things mainly, if they were to accomplish fixing these three things, I would have a very difficult time finding anything terribly wrong with the game, anything that really bothered me, let's say that. that's the urgency in animations, which TJ touched on briefly, as far as you preload your throw, but you still get stuck in a slow animation, and you don't get the guy out at first because of it, or you get deep ball over your head in the outfield, you get to it, but then very slow in getting the ball back into the infield, allowing the opponent to take an extra base, a double triple.
And these are...
I've had inside the park home runs done because of those slow animations. Rich?
Yeah, no, these are very easy to recognize when they happen, and I got to imagine that they are extremely difficult to get right, because if they were easy or even moderately challenging to get right, they've had a few cracks at the bat at this, no pun intended, and it has been something, an issue that, or a couple of issues that have been sort of plaguing the series, so to speak. And I use that in the least negative terms, because obviously this is my favorite game and has been for the last couple of years. So like to your point, Brian, if they get these things, what in the heck could possibly be left as a problem?
Yeah. So steal attempts was my second. And then the third was bunting. TJ, do you get any sense of how bunting is going to turn out this year based on what they've said, what they've showed?
Yeah, we got a little bit of look at it. I mean, I was not super impressed with what I saw. I was kind of disappointed by that. They didn't really have teams with great bunters on them, and of course they did a couple
that's never stopped anybody from bunting,
right? Right, and they did a couple, and it's like, oh look, this one popped behind, or it was, I think they had Jason Kipnis, and the first one he did, he fouled it straight back. Second one he did, he laid down like a perfect bunt, and this was just doing like a sack bunt, laid down like a sack bunt. And then there was a couple more that were like good, but he was getting thrown out and stuff. But then they switched over to Wilson Contreras, who is the Cubs catcher. It looked like they had last year's rosters loaded, or like the final roster from last year. He has like 32 bunt. And yes, there was like one or two that he fouled off or like popped up to the pitcher. But I think he laid down like seven straight perfectly down the line.
Yeah.
And he got thrown out a couple times. But he's also a catcher, so. But if that was anybody else with 32 contact with or 32 bunt with, you know,
low speed,
any semblance of speed, they would have beat that out very easily. Nick Livingston, one of the developers, I believe he was on Reddit earlier saying like, we realize this is still after the stream. They're like, all right, we realize this is still a problem, and he's been apparently he's been talking to people trying to work on that. So
we'll
see if that. Does something.
Well, there's a benefit. I mean, that's one of, we talk about betas, we talk about early streams, we talk about early videos, whatever it might be. Sometimes the feedback you get can help actually improve the what's going to end up being the release product. Now, so Rich, I wanted to get your two opinions on this anyway, because I know it's been derided mostly since it was proposed, but this idea of putting a base runner on second base in extra innings, which would very fundamentally change the show. I don't think there's any chance that happens for this season, but in future seasons, it would fundamentally change the way we play the game, strategy, and everything going into extra innings. Rich, do you like this idea? Because I kind of do. Once you get to the 12th or maybe 13th inning, feel like this could actually spice things up a bit.
Yeah. You know what? I feel about this the same way that I feel about the 4-on-4, the 3-on-3 hockey in NHL overtime. If this is regular season stuff, I'm cool with it.
Yeah.
Right? If this becomes a postseason thing, I'm not cool with it. They've been playing baseball for 150 years or so. And by the way, I'm not anti-progress. I'm not anti-changing thing. I love the college football overtime, for example. I like the NFL overtime modifications. I'm all for tweaking and making adjustments. And I get that they're looking to preserve pitchers and conserve or, you know, reduce the amount of time. So all that said, if this is something they want to do in the regular season, after a few innings of extra innings, I'm fine with it. I think it could be interesting. Everybody's playing by the same rules, so it's not like there's any extra advantage. I'm fine with it. As long as it stays a regular season thing and doesn't move to the postseason, I'm all for it. Let's have a little fun.
Yeah, that's pretty much how I feel about it. I don't think it would be in the postseason. At least I presume it wouldn't be. TJ, what do you think of this idea?
It's an interesting thing to try. I know some, I believe there's some leagues like around the world that actually do it. And I guess they seem to like it, or they would have taken it out already. I think they're doing it, what, in like low A or something?
Well, this year they're going to test out? It definitely makes sense for minors where you're trying to preserve young arms, right? Mm-hmm. So I can see them experimenting with it there and it working. Now the question, I guess, is whether it would translate well to the majors.
Yeah, and I know, I think they were thinking about it for the World Baseball Classic. I almost feel like they kind of did it last year, but I think that's wrong. Maybe they were doing it in spring training games or something, but it's an interesting idea. I know Japan ends their games after 14 innings if it's a tie, I believe. I don't know. I don't know how much I like the idea of tinkering with stuff, but I mean,
it is kind of, want to
not throw four pitches for a walk, so an intentional walk. So I don't know.
Which I'm also fine with too, by the way. I mean, if you know you're going to intentionally walk him, just say go to first base. I have no problem with that either.
That's a disadvantage to the offensive team.
What are you talking about?
Because if you have to, if you as a pitcher have to throw four pitches, you know, 5 feet out of the strike zone,
right?
You're not going to be super crisp throwing that next one back into the strike zone.
This to me is a lot like the extra point debate in the NFL. Like the chances of something interesting happening on a not a pitch out, but on an intentional walk. On an intentional throw. You know, it has happened, but the chances are so slim. You know, 1%, whatever it might be. That it's just not interesting. Now, I don't, that's what, that saves maybe 30 seconds, 45 seconds of game time, so I don't think that's going to dramatically change if their goal is to, this is going to shorten games. There's a lot of things that they could do better than just take those pitches out, but.
Yeah, I think they were trying to say that it was more of a pace of play thing, not a overall game time fix.
Well, that
I'm all for it.
There's other things they can, there's definitely other things they can do to address that too, so.
Well, and then the other part of it, though, is baseball. Part of the appeal of baseball is that you're not really entirely sure how long it's going to be, right? It's the only sport that doesn't have a clock. And there is a bit of a, as a fan, a relaxed nature to baseball.
That's the good and the bad. I'll tell you, though, Rich, like, you know, a lot of people take their kids, and you'll know this, take your kids and get them on a school night or whatever, and then it goes into the 13th inning, then you have to debate whether you're leaving the game. That could have a very exciting ending or not. It's tough.
No, I totally get it, and I love taking my son to baseball games, but we go to minor league games, AA games, right, where the breaks are a lot shorter, and it is a faster pace of play, and they've had the pitch clock countdown, you know, the amount of time that you have for the last couple of years. So you see a lot of these pace of play improvements first when you go to like these AA games like I do for the Trenton Thunder. And it's nice. It's good. I'm all for being aware that, you know, people do have things to do in their lives. And I totally get that. And I'm, you know, I'm well known for being like, come on, I just want to play. Let's get to it. Let's move. That's why I like the don't need to throw the four pitches kind of thing. So really, I think the bigger issue is that as the game has gotten more specialized, the dictation for the need for more pitchers has been more pronounced. Mm. I doubt they would ever do it. But a lot of these kind of problems could be solved if you add another pitcher or two and you just put a limit on the amounts of switches that you can do during the early parts of games.
Yeah.
That, I think, would really change things much more for the better, because this is really more about preserving pitching than it is about anything else.
All right, let's transition to the return of, well, it's called the spiritual successor to Mutant League Football. And I don't think the rights are owned to that actual name, despite the creator of it and lead designer of it, which was released originally in 1993. He's back. He's doing now Mutant Football League, not Mutant League Football, but Mutant Football League. And that's been in development for a number of years now. It was actually a Kickstarter project in 2013 that failed. It only earned 19% of its goal, which was an ambitious and frankly unrealistic $750,000 goal. It was also framed as a mobile first type game. Mobile was the main platform, and then they were going to go to Xbox 360 and PS3. So they continued development on the game despite the Kickstarter failure. And now they came back to Kickstarter here last week and launched, seeking only $60,000. And that $60,000 was for a specific purpose. It was for the online portion of the game. The actual game was not reliant on Kickstarter, which I think is an important thing to note, because a lot of people are really hesitant, including myself, to pledge towards a Kickstarter project that may never see the light of day. There's been plenty of those, and that just leaves you many years off, and even if you do that, and even if it does get delivered. But instead, you had here was a near-complete game that was just looking to add a piece on. And so it only took 3 days for Mutant Football League to reach its goal of 60,000. It's well over that now. And they're actually adding stretch goals. So Mutant Football League, I'll just give you the log line here, is an NFL Blitz arcade-style football game with nasty mutants, ferocious monsters, deadly chainsaws, and lots of gory player deaths, along with some edgy, satirical humor that parodies America's favorite sport. So this is an interesting thing, because Michael Mendheim, again, I'm hoping to have him on for an interview and do a piece for Sporting News on the game. He's driving the development of this new one, and he was, as I mentioned earlier, created and designed the original. Now this one has added online. It's got a lot of other interesting stuff, and we're in this time where, Rich, we have a number of games coming from independent developers, a number of sports games that maybe a few years ago didn't seem like would ever come about. We have baseball, which is getting a sequel. We have surfing. We have a hockey arcade game from an independent developer coming up. And now we have this Mutant Football League coming up, which is looking at releasing later this year on PC and early next year for PS4 and Xbox One. What do you think, Rich, of what you've seen out of Mutant Football League so far?
Well, I will be fascinated to see how the market reacts to this, because it's been a long time since this IP has been relevant. It is a very different gaming landscape now than it was when this was on the market. I just don't know. I have no real feel for this. I'm personally not a Mutant League Football. I mean, I tried it way back when on, I believe, the Genesis, and yeah, it didn't stick with me. But this is also was a time in my life where, you know, I had to be extremely judicious with the games that I bought. You know, like those were expensive. I hardly had any money. I would get two or three games a year. So, you know, that's why I don't have a whole lot of experience with it. So, man, I just don't know. It's not the kind of game that I think will appeal to as many people as perhaps the people who comment on it say that there will be. This feels like one of those games where there's a small but very vocal group of people who will pay money to see it. Mm-hmm. What'll be really fascinating is if it really does hit a larger market. I don't know, but I'm rooting for it. I can't tell you that I can make any worthwhile prediction or even whether I'm gonna really enjoy it or not. It's hard to say.
Yeah, I think what's good here is you have an entry point for people that isn't too much. So as part of the Kickstarter, the standard level would be a $25, the $25 tier. And that's where you get a copy of the game, a digital copy of the game for the platform of your choice. And you also get access to the beta this summer. So people are going to have an opportunity to play not just a beta this summer, but a higher tier will get you into the alpha, so you can actually play the game even earlier. And they gave a small slice of that out to anyone who contributed at least $1. They have these stretch goals now, which include, and they've reached five of them already. They're adding more teams, certain unlockables, new character species, fields, gorier special effects. Eventually, if it gets high enough, things like a halftime mini game and a full season, full 13-game season with playoffs. So, again, ambitious on the stretch goals, but not out of the realm of possibility as we've seen so far. There seems to be an interest, but like you said, Rich, it's very, people are very careful with their money now, and they're not gambling it away, and that's why Kickstarters for video games have trended downwards. But we have already over 1,500 people who backed Mutant Football League, which is more than it originally got in 2013 over a month period, and it's only been 5-6 days. So, very promising. TJ, do you have any thoughts on this kind of a different style of game with Mutant Football League than we get with Madden?
Yeah, I mean, it looks very Blitz-like from what I can tell. I don't remember, I don't think I ever played the original back in the day. But I feel like Blitz did come back without, you know, the over-the-top craziness. Uh-huh. And people didn't really buy that. And I feel like the people that would be playing this like Blitz, but want, like, a different subset. So I don't know really if the if the market's going to be big enough.
Blitz came back as an NFL-licensed game.
Right, and they had to take out all the stuff. Yeah, like the all the cushions stuff. All that stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
So I just don't know if there is a big enough market for this to be super successful. But I mean, I wish them the best luck, because more sports games, the better, right? So,
yeah, I think the market demands a lot of depth. Mm. I mean, we see it with all of the major console sports games. You know, TJ and I see it every day with Out of the Park and Franchise Hockey Manager. The sports video game players are incredibly savvy, incredibly smart, and the old school experiences don't offer nearly the amount of depth of gameplay that we've been spoiled with in the last few generations. And there, it's really difficult to bridge that gap. You know, even games like Super Mega Baseball had a pretty solid lengthy season mode and several interesting mechanics that you could really explore and learn how to use. And the system escapes me for, you know, difficulty, but they had really interesting
ego system.
Yes. The ego system was brilliant. And it's those subtle things that really have to be there. You've got to offer more than a 10 or a 15 minute experience to really get people excited about your game. Or conversely, it needs to have something be so excellent that it is unassailable, like Rocket League. Rocket League is just a spectacular, brief experience that is wildly repeatable and incredibly fun. And if you're not hitting either a whole lot of depth or just being absolutely spectacular in a repeatable process, it's really, that's even more challenging in 2017 to get a large group of people to buy your game or to spend money, as well as to generate the kind of buzz that you need in a marketplace that is so crowded that it's almost impossible to get noticed anymore.
Yeah. I can't think of a sports video game that's come through on Kickstarter. I don't think there have been any, which is interesting. I mean, there have been some for other genres and some bigger ones, but for sports, there have been attempts at them, and they've always failed. They've always expected higher, that they would get a greater amount of money than they, and it comes nowhere close to that. Because people, like you said, Rich, are conscious of what they can get in the market already and the capabilities of some of these developers who maybe don't have experience in the area. And so they're very hesitant to contribute to those projects. And so this might be the first one that's going to come through successfully. But like I said, that's because the game itself wasn't dependent on it. Now they just needed to finish up the online area. Now they're doing extras to go along with it and getting people's feedback on what those should be. That's how they came up with the stretch goals. But it'll definitely be interesting. I think it's we can use something different. We're seeing that with like old time hockey. We're seeing it with Super Mega Baseball, and the golf club, which is more of a simulation. But again, kind of challenging the norms we're used to from the big publishers. So.
Yeah, and you mentioned, sorry to interrupt, but you mentioned a few things that are really great, more great examples, right? The golf club, I don't know financially how well it did. It did well enough for a small independent studio to produce a second version of it. It also didn't really heavily monetize. It was a one-time price to buy it, and then there was a season mode or something that got added onto it. But and while we know our friend Owen Good couldn't stand it, I loved it, still love it, because it really was a very interesting way to play the game, a very simulation heavy version of the game, and offered just a wonderful way to play golf with your friends in real time, and a great almost unlimited amount of courses. So again, they really did a lot of things right to get people to buy their game. And I'm not suggesting that Mutant League Football or Mutant Football League won't have that depth, or that it won't offer, you know, the enough of experience for people to buy their to spend their money. But man, you know, I have the same concern about old time hockey, right? I mean, it looks like it might be fun for a few minutes, but unless there's really something there that you can sink your teeth into, you know, I mean, I have the NES Classic, and Tecmo Bowl is on there, and it's fun to play for a few minutes, but that's really it, you know, like there's nothing. And I know it's a very, very old game, but it's a pure nostalgia play. But I didn't buy the NES Classic for Tecmo Bowl, and I don't know how much I'll play it. I might randomly play a friend of mine every once in a while, but I don't know. Again, I keep like feel like I'm repeating myself, but that's because I am. But they got to really do a lot right to get noticed in this market. They got to do a lot right.
Yep, and they still got a little time to put work into that. So I'm encouraged. I think they're going the right direction with it. We'll just have to see how it all turns out, and we'll get a better idea of that in the months ahead. Finally, yep. I wanted to touch on something we've discussed within the last couple of years, at least, and that's the relevance of E3. And so they announced this week that E3 will now be accepting in the public. They're going to be selling tickets for, I think, a certain number, like first 1,000 or something, will get in for $150, and they'll go up to 15,000 or something, and the remaining ones will go for $250. Either way, it's taking more of the model of a Comic-Con or a PAX that where you can buy entry in. Well, E3 in the past was always an industry event. So you had press, and you also had people in the industry, developers, people who work at gaming stores, the buyers, publishers, whoever it might be, anyone who's involved in the industry could get in. Now, even with those people, without allowing the general public in, is a disaster. I mean, it got worse over the years, and I think it's been 3 or 4 years since I went, and I stopped going because I started getting nothing out of even attending. There's pretty much nothing of interest out of those events. And it was just very, it wasn't, I'm not trying to complain about having to go to E3, but you don't get to do much. You don't get much time with individuals who are working on the games, and you don't get much time with your hands on the actual games. And when you do, it's a very uncomfortable environment where you can't really assess what the game is, what it's going to be like when you have it at home. So I just felt like the value of going was completely gone. And now you're going to be adding in more people. So last year, attendance was down slightly, and it ended up being about 50,000. This year, you know, if they're adding in the public, potentially you're looking at 60, 65,000. And I just can't even imagine walking the show floor, Rich.
E3 has long since passed the high point of its existence. The reason for it to exist originally was as a trade show where buyers and sellers would get together and arrange the stock for later in the year. It was an offshoot of other electronics trade events, and then sort of became a great platform for the companies to announce their new games and to crow about their financial successes. It's been very, E3 has been a lot of different things over the years, and it's just clear that in our current market, where the publishers of games have completely taken ownership of the message. You know, they all do their own press now. They all do their own live streams. They all run their own social networks. They literally don't need the press anymore. And between that and companies like EA leaving E3 altogether, Nintendo leaving E3 altogether.
Exactly, yeah.
You know, I mean, it's just, there's really no point to it anymore for most people's perspective. I know there are still people who go and get big deals done and stuff like that. You know, but with everything that you said, Brian, there's just the E3 is just not a place where many people can have work get done. I mean, look, TJ and I are in the game development world right now. We have no point. There's no reason for either of us to go to this event. We're not going to get any deals done there. From a press perspective, I've gone multiple times. Like you say, it's impossible to have a good experience with a bunch of noise and people standing around you, and the people who are manning the booth are all exhausted and cranky and their feet hurt. And it's big, loud, ugly. It's almost pointless. And I am not surprised that they're letting the public, because they probably got a year or two where they'll still have enough on the show floor to be interesting. But I think between PlayStation Experience and EA Play and whatever Activision is going to do, and you know, this E3 as we know it is on its way out, and that's okay. I'm not even lamenting anything. I'm not happily cheering for it to go away. Just the industry is evolving, and E3 really doesn't have a purpose to serve like it used to.
TJ, now I know you haven't ever been to E3. But
I've seen videos online.
Yeah, well, that's the thing is, you can probably I joke about it, but it's true. I can cover E3 better from home. But so you'd be able to get in as a member of the industry. But let's say you weren't. Would the public being allowed, would that make you interested, or would you be interested in going and attending an E3?
I think back in the day, I would have been really interested. But as I've actually seen like more footage from like Giant Bomb doing stuff there, and seeing like the lines of people, even when it's an industry event, there were lines that were like, what was it, like 2 hours to shoot a basketball for some reason with NBA 2K, but I don't think you actually got to play the game. I think you just took a shot at a hoop and the line was like 2 hours long, but this is an industry thing, so I don't know how that works. that doesn't seem like something a reporter would want to wait online for 2 hours for.
Well, you never know. Point some people do.
Even like when we go to PAX East, like those lines are real long, and
it's
feel like
insanity.
If you don't have appointments, I mean,
yeah,
I don't know why you would even try to go.
But I've had appointments, TJ, and those are pointless too, because you show up to the booth. And, you know, the only appointments where you get anything at all are the behind closed doors appointments, right? And I've been able to have those in the past. But even those, I mean, again, it's such an unpleasant environment. You can't have a conversation. The person you're talking to is either the 5th or the 25th or the 310th. Time that they've answered the same questions or done the same demo. It's there's just very little that is there anymore that really helps anyone get any work accomplished. Now, let's say that I was able to get, you know, my employer to pay for it, right? Because obviously Out of the Park, we're a tiny little company, right? There's no way that Out of the Park could exhibit at at E3.
And then you have to pay me to come out there too, so.
Right. Well, let's just say, you know, I got out there. What I would enjoy about E3 would be getting together with all the people in the industry after the conference, you know, at a bar or restaurant, going out to dinner, which coincidentally, TJ, my best PAX East experiences have always been the dinner that we have after we do our panel. And because you look at that show floor and I just look down at it and I go, why would anybody venture into that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think it would actually be nice to just go and not even go to E3. Exactly. And just go to see everybody. I feel like you would get a lot more accomplished doing that.
But. Well, I think you see a lot of people going that route, whether it's meetings off-site or just going to an EA Play type of thing. And maybe you go to E3, maybe you have meetings there, maybe you have them off-site, but... Yeah, there's different avenues to take, but I think we all kind of agree that the concept of the way that E3 was built and everything is pretty much gone at this point, and it's just, you know, the final nail in the coffin, and they're just trying to get some money out of it when they can. But
well, I mean, the ESA, which is the group that runs this, needs to continue to fund its existence, right? This is an organization that is I don't know the specifics of it, but I mean, it represents the entire video game industry. That's who sponsors and puts on this event. Mm-hmm. So the E3 will continue as long as there is an ESA that is trying to justify its existence, fund its existence as an organization. The ESA also has to try to represent the industry in Washington and lobby for, you know, helping protect video game companies from laws that are deemed, not friendly to the industry and stuff like that, too. So E3 only goes away when the ESA decides it goes away. But I just, I'm having a hard time, you know, when you have Electronic Arts back out and you have Nintendo back out, how much longer will they even be able to continue as an organization to run this? You know, conversely, they could always make it smaller or bring it to a different place and maybe open it up to make it more affordable for smaller groups of people to go. But then it's not really E3. It's something different. So, yeah, it's fascinating, but it will continue as long as the ESA continues, because this is probably the big money maker for that organization to even continue to exist.
Yeah.
And people want to go to these. I mean, I feel like there's a new PAX every 2 years or something coming up.
Yeah.
I think they're actually even talking about even doing more PAXes. So I think there's East, or they all have new names now, right?
East,
the East Coast, West Coast, Australia. There's one in Texas. I feel like I heard they were talking about doing one up in like Chicago or something. People want to see these things. So
absolutely. No, they totally do. And there's also obviously BlizzCon, right? And the PlayStation experience. Yeah. But E3 is not those. E3 has always been an industry event, and those things that you're talking about, TJ, are fan oriented. They're literally built for the fans. So that's where E3 is different. I feel like if I were the kind of person who wanted to go to a conference, I have no shortage of choices to go to. And I don't know if E3 does go that route. I don't know what they're even doing anymore, because there's already so many ways for fans to get together.
All right. Well, Rich Grisham, thank you. You can find Rich on Twitter at Rich Grisham. TJ Larriman, thank you for coming on again. You can find him on Twitter at ThatSportsGamer. And I'm Brian Weedeye. You can find me at PastaPadre. Thank you very much for listening this week. We're going to be back next week with another episode. Take care till then.